Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, an exploration of two of the biggest, most hot-button issues in all of politics right now, guns and homelessness, with two of the people at the center of both of those debates. A little bit later on, we'll talk to our panel. But let's begin, though, with the two newsmakers of the week. Beto O'Rourke making a trip to California this week to talk about guns, and Dr. Ben Carson, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, to talk about homelessness. Let's begin with Beto O'Rourke, who, of course, got so much attention after the shooting in El Paso in his hometown. He comes out for a mandatory gun buyback. But I have so many questions about how that would actually work. So we got a few minutes to talk to him about that. Here's what he has to say.
So the big issue right now is guns, something that you've gotten so much attention for, this position to take away AR-15s, AK-47s. How do you actually do that? Is that a constitutional amendment? Is that an executive order? Is that a bill passed by Congress? How do you do it?
We do it. As a country, we decide that the lives of our fellow Americans, especially our kids, who far too often are hunted down in their classrooms and the hallways of their schools, are the most important thing. And we're going to make sure that we protect your Second Amendment right to have a gun, to hunt, to protect yourself in your home, but that there is no right to own a weapon of war, an AR-15 or an AK-47 that was designed and engineered to kill people as effectively, as efficiently as possible on a battlefield. I'm listening not just to Democrats on this, but Republicans, non-gun owners and gun owners alike, including owners of AR-15s, and they by and large agree that this is what we should do as a country. So I expect Americans to comply with the law. Those who own AR-15s will understand that surrendering those weapons is in the best interests of our fellow Americans and making sure that we address an epidemic of gun violence that takes more than 40,000 lives a year.
But is that a law that you pass? Is that something you just put out there? I mean, how do you actually get this done?
It's a law that would be passed by the American people through their representatives in Congress, a law which I would sign and a law which I would enforce. We've seen this happen in other countries. Australia had a mandatory buyback of AR-15s and AK-47s after a deadly mass shooting there. And it's estimated that 16 mass shootings have been prevented since that law has been adopted. We know that we can do this. We just have to show the political will, reflect the public sentiment that's alive and well in America right now, importantly being led by young people like March for Our Lives and everyday Americans like Moms Demand Action, who are going to make sure that they are more than a match for the NRA.
You know, the NRA, though, would say that this is illegal to do it. It's against the Constitution. They will likely sue over something like this. We've seen their lawsuits over and over again. How do you fight this in court, especially with a Supreme Court that has a lot of conservatives on it right now?
Yeah. If we are afraid of the NRA, if we allow our fear of the courts to keep us from moving, then we are complicit in the gun deaths and the violence that we've seen. Justice Scalia opined from the Supreme Court that the Second Amendment right is not an absolute one, that there are some common sense constraints like keeping weapons of war out of the hands of our fellow Americans. No one would argue that you should have a grenade launcher or be able to drive a tank down the street. This AR-15, and you can take it from the words of the man who designed it himself, was not intended for civilian use. The ability to kill people in record numbers, to impose a kind of suffering and harm that's hard for us to imagine unless we've experienced it, is not something that we should accept in this country. And I refuse to accept it. And I won't allow fear of the NRA, any corporation, any political interest to keep me from doing the right thing. I'm going to stand up for my fellow Americans.
El Paso, when that shooting happened, how did that change you as a man? How did that change you as a candidate?
El Paso showed me the real cost and consequence of Donald Trump. That, you know, a racism and a violence that had been alive and well in this country from the very beginning of this country was welcomed out into the open and directed at El Paso, Texas. I mean, this is the president who said Mexicans are rapists and criminals, who warned of invasions and infestations and killers and predators. And then when someone at one of his rallies in May said, shoot them, when referring to immigrants, the president smiled and laughed. He said this was okay to do. And a killer with an AK-47 drove 600 miles and came to El Paso, really directed that way by the president of the United States. It changed me because it told me that we can no longer keep quiet. We can no longer fail to call things for what they are. We can no longer meet this threat with anything less than the urgency that it deserves. And that's the way that I've been speaking. That's the way I've been bringing my fellow Americans into this. And that's the way that we're going to affect the change that we want to see.
And last question. We talked to you earlier about homelessness. You're also talking about criminal justice reform today.
Yeah.
On the issue of marijuana, Should marijuana be illegal in the United States?
Marijuana should be legal in the United States. Never again should one of our fellow human beings be locked up for possession of something that's already legal in more than half the states in the country. And furthermore, we should expunge the arrest records for those caught in possession of that substance. And then I think we have to go a step further and address the issue of equity. Disproportionately, African Americans have been locked up for possession of something that all Americans use at a roughly the same rate. We need to make sure that when it comes to marijuana-based businesses and entrepreneurship, there's an even shot at success for those who've borne the brunt of a criminal justice system that is patently unfair.
Just to wrap things up, on our show last week, Bob Schrum, the political strategist, said that during the debates you were Beto Unchained. Our debate focus group said that you won over everybody else. They were most impressed by you. They weren't even thinking of voting for you, and now they are thinking of voting for you. Do you feel a sense of relief that you're sort of finally just doing things the way you want to do them? Is that a change for you?
My job's going to be to see things as clearly as I can, to speak as honestly as I can, and to be as decisive as possible about the solution. So on gun violence, it means being honest about the fact that universal background checks and red flag laws and an end to the sale of weapons of war are good steps but are insufficient. And so we'll say the politically difficult but absolutely necessary thing that we need to buy those weapons back. On our drug laws, we'll talk about the changes that we need to make, including ending for-profit prisons and cash bail. We'll talk about a racism that infects every single part of American life, including our economy and healthcare and education, and how we need to address that by having every single American tell their story, by doing so telling the full American story. This is the kind of conversation we need to have as a country, the kind of conversation I'm grateful to be leading as a candidate for the presidency.
Our thanks to Beto O'Rourke. Now let's talk about another big issue, homelessness. I actually spent some time with Beto O'Rourke on Skid Row this week. He expressed some concern about some of the stuff that the Trump administration is saying in terms of their homelessness policy. They haven't been real clear. They floated out a bunch of different ideas. So try to get some clarity from the man who's in charge of that policy for the Trump administration, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Ben Carson. Here's our interview.
Secretary Carson, welcome back to The Issue.
Thank you.
So homelessness, yes. The most important issue to so many people in the state of California right now.
Yes.
One of the questions has been, what exactly is the Trump administration proposing? There's these reports that potentially police would break up some of these tent cities, yeah. Send people into vacant government buildings. Is that true?
What is true is that we're looking at a whole slew of options. I personally want to come out here and see what the atmosphere was. Mm-hmm. Talk to some of the residents and hear from some of the people who actually have found some solutions. And we'll put all that together. We would like to work with the city and the state. It doesn't seem sometimes that they really want to work with us, but the key thing is we've got people out there on the street, and it's not just because they're on the street, it's because they're creating very unsanitary conditions, which can be the precursor to an epidemic. And that can affect the entire population. Not to mention the fact that, by them being in certain areas, it precludes other people from being there. These are public spaces, and we shouldn't have a group of people sort of precluding others from taking advantage.
Okay, a lot to unpack in what you just said, so let's start with the beginning. So it is... This police option, is that an option? I mean, that is something you guys are considering, to essentially break up the tent cities?
Well, let's put it this way. I think it is important that we support and empower the police so that they feel that when there are people who are unruly and who are infringing on the rights of others, they feel that they have the ability to go in and do something about it.
So do you think right now the police do not have sort of what they need to do their jobs?
Certainly, as you know, there have been many stories of police not feeling backed up.
So what kind of changes would you like to see?
Well, again, the real success here comes only when the federal government is able to work with the state and the local government and not necessarily point fingers at each other and spend all their time doing things that don't matter, but actually doing some analysis here. And, the police law enforcement is just a small part of the puzzle for solving this problem. So, you know, we don't want to take one piece of the puzzle and blow that up. You know, it's a holistic approach that will solve this.
What is the nature of your relationship with the governor of California, with the mayor of Los Angeles, with the mayor of San Francisco, and why aren't you meeting with them during this trip?
Well, this trip is really more for us to gather some facts. You know, we're getting a lot of suggestions about what to do, and I don't know that you can really utilize those suggestions to the greatest extent if you haven't experienced the atmosphere.
But in terms of your relationship with them, you said it's a lot of finger pointing right now?
You know, I've heard a lot of finger pointing. I don't, as you probably have noticed, participate in such things myself because I tend to be more focused on how do we solve a problem? And that probably comes from my medical background. You can sit there and talk for 3 years about how come this person's liver is not functioning, or you can say, how do we get it to work?
Right. Literally life and death. The governor of California says one of the ways to solve the problem is he wants 50,000 vouchers for affordable housing for some of these folks on the street. What say you to that?
I would say let's sit down. We're quite happy to provide some technical assistance to help them utilize the vouchers they already have. They're not utilizing those to the maximum extent. The HUD VASH vouchers, the ones for the veterans, they're only using 65% of them. There are others that are not being used effectively. So, you know, rather than just throwing more and more money toward a problem, let's create efficiency with what we've already allocated.
You know, I was with you, I remember, during your first tour to Skid Row, and you've now been in this job for several years. Homelessness is perhaps the most complicated problem in our society right now. Having now met a lot of these people, been in this job for a few years, lived this, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about homelessness? What have you learned in this job that you maybe didn't know before you started it?
Well, a lot of people think that most of the people who are homeless are lacking mental facilities. And that's not necessarily the case, although quite a large number are. And that's a societal issue that we have to face because, you know, a few decades ago, we decided for economic reasons to discharge people who really did need assistance in living and say, you're on your own. Well, you know, that's like taking, you know, an adolescent or a kid and saying, okay, go out there on your own. That's not compassionate at all, quite frankly. And we need to be working with the American Psychiatric Association and some of the other groups to help us to fashion the right kind of way to take care of people so that we actually consider their rights, but at the same time, we consider the rights of everyone else. I'm not considering your rights if I let somebody sit in front of your house who is violent and might harm you or your family when you come out. So I have to consider everybody's rights when we're talking solutions.
Well, and part of considering the rights that makes this so complicated is, do we have a right to force somebody into like a mental hospital? Do you have a homeless right to force a homeless person into maybe one of those empty government buildings and out of a camp? How do you see that situation?
Well, I think if they're dangerous and they're infringing upon the rights of other citizens in such a way that you know, they can't be reasoned with, then obviously you want to maintain order. That's just like when you have a house with children and you have one that's just unruly and it's destroying everything. I mean, what do? You say, oh, okay, you know, he's the right to do that. Yeah. Or do you step in?
You know, Los Angeles County have passed big measures, spending a lot of money to deal with this issue. And yet the problem is getting worse. The homeless count up this past year.
Considerably up.
In your term, too, in what you are doing in the federal government. What's going wrong? I mean, why is it getting worse?
Well, I think, you know, we're doing a lot of things that don't make sense. For instance, there are incredible barriers to building affordable housing in this area. And, you know, it's a matter of supply and demand. And if you can't build affordable housing, of course it's going to get worse every year. That's what we really need to be concentrating on.
So what does that look like? Does that mean changes in terms of zoning laws? I mean, that Better or Work yesterday talked about inclusionary housing. How do you make that work?
There's a whole variety of things that are available. You have to be willing to use them. In the jurisdictions where people are willing to use them, we just don't have this problem. Mm. And you look at a place like Tokyo, which has more people than New York City, and virtually no homelessness. Mm-hmm. So now, how does that happen? It's because if you go there, they don't have restrictions on everything. You know, in San Francisco, a single person can stop a multifamily development. I object. Okay. You know, that doesn't make any sense. So, you know, a little bit of common sense, a little bit of logic would make a big difference.
I mean, that is one of the big questions, this NIMBYism, right? Not in my backyard. It'd be great to deal with homelessness as long as I'm not the one dealing with homelessness.
Right. And I understand NIMBYism.
How do you deal with that?
Education. Because NIMBYism is based on misinformation. People think the government still does things the way we did it in the 60s and the 70s with these gigantic multifamily constructs, with little forethought, afterthought, or any kind of thought. Mm. And the thing immediately starts to deteriorate, and it takes down the value of everything around it. We don't do that anymore. Now we're talking about public-private partnerships. Mm. We're talking about mixed income. We're talking about things that are architecturally consistent with the environment. We're talking about places where nurses and teachers and firemen can live in the same neighborhood where they work, which I think enhances the value. You know, that's a much more intelligent way of doing things. Obviously, we're not talking about building a multifamily structure in the middle of a single block neighborhood. You know, there is actually some common sense here and there.
Speaking of that, sometimes there's some wild accusations said about the Trump administration. We don't get a chance to talk to the Trump administration all that often. Okay. What do you think is sort of the biggest misconception out there about the Trump administration and about you?
Well, I think, you know, this whole concept of everybody being a racist, I think is just totally childlike and absurd. And, you know, I think a lot of people think that, you know, I need this job, that this is something that I really wanted to do. I was extremely happy for the years that I was practicing medicine, and then I retired for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Those were some of the best years of my life. And the only reason that I ran for president and the only reason I'm doing this is because I'm very concerned about what's happening with our country. And if people before our time had always taken the easy road, where would we be as a nation?
And last question for you. We do something on our show called Personal Issues, which is a little bit of fun. It's like 30 seconds of quick-fire questions to just get to know you a little better.
Okay.
So here we go. You ready? Mm-hmm. What's your favorite book?
The Bible.
Favorite holiday?
Christmas.
Favorite nickname?
Ben.
Favorite liberal?
I always tell Al Hunt and Judy Woodruff they're my favorite liberals.
Reporters, favorite meal?
Broccoli chiquette.
Favorite candy?
My wife.
His wife is named Candy, if you guys don't know. And favorite quote or motto?
Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths.
And you know, this is a big day, because it's your birthday today.
It is.
So happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
How do you celebrate? How does Dr. Carson celebrate a birthday?
By waking up in the morning. You know, it's interesting, because I'm here. I'm going to be in San Diego this evening. My wife is opening up six Carson reading rooms in the San Diego area today and tomorrow. So we will actually be able to spend my birthday together.
Ah, well, happy birthday. Thank you for spending part of it with us.
Thank you
Dr. Ben Carson.
our thank you and a happy birthday to Dr. Carson. So now let's unpack what we just heard from both of them, a panel to help us do that. With us this week is Holly Mitchell, state senator, represents much of L.A. County. She's now running for the L.A. County Board of Supervisors. Seema Mehta from the L.A. Times, one of their top political reporters traveling the country talking about the presidential race. And Joel Pollack, who's also traveling the country talking about the presidential race. He writes for Breitbart News. We started our conversation by talking about homelessness.
Welcome all. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Just heard from Dr. Carson on homelessness. You, as somebody who works on this issue from the state perspective, what's your reaction to what you just heard?
Well, I would love, as a state legislator, for the federal government to come in and be a true partner in helping LA County, LA City figure out how we find appropriate housing for our 60-some-odd thousand friends, family, and neighbors who are unhoused. So come on, federal government, help us out.
He said no to 50,000 vouchers for affordable housing, something the governor is asking for.
And that's unfortunate, because I think what's really clear is we can't build our way out of this moral dilemma fast enough. And so creating opportunities of existing housing stock, helping people stay where they are, should be a part of our overall comprehensive solution.
Joel, what's the federal government's role in all of this?
Well, there are laws that allow the federal government to intervene if there's an emergency. And in fact, the Stafford Act of 1988 allows the president to override the governor. And you could see FEMA come in and start treating parts of LA as a disaster area. And if there really were an epidemic, and some people are warning that there could be, we had a typhus outbreak last year, there could be bubonic plague, which is endemic to parts of Southern California. So there are concerns about public health. But the other issues I think we're not talking about, and maybe don't fit within a traditional housing and urban development model, are drug addiction and mental health. And those are issues that we need state law to help us deal with. We have, not just in California, but around the country, a kind of taboo about the sort of involuntary commitment to mental institutions that used to be more common. And certainly nobody would want someone to be sent to a facility who doesn't belong there. But there are a lot of people on the street who will decline housing if it's offered to them because they either prefer to live on the street or because they have underlying mental illnesses and drug addictions that can't really be dealt with in a traditional pay for the rent, go find a job. Mm-hmm. Ordinary life. They need help. They need intervention. Right. And if they don't get it, we're going to see this problem get worse.
I would just say that California has responded, and that California is a housing first state, because I'm also clear that to be able to deal with whatever your addiction or challenge is, housing should be a fundamental right. You need to have a place to be before you can begin to address with those issues. The other piece is making sure we actually have capacity. You know, we are getting away from state mental health facilities. And we didn't keep up with the initial commitment by a former governor to close state hospitals and open community-based facilities. So the other issue is really infrastructure, in terms of, do we have adequate spaces, appropriate spaces to allow people to receive treatment.
So you think we need more state mental facilities?
No, I think we need community-based support programs that meet the needs. Many people who are unhoused also prefer to be on the streets, because they also don't want to go into the kind of facilities which are very limited that we currently have.
It's pretty wild. You know, Jill's talking about the bubonic plague and things like that. This is something that's now driving some of the presidential campaign as well. Beto O'Rourke on Skid Row, Bernie Sanders on Skid Row. This is something they're talking about.
One area we're not talking about is veterans, which is an area where it seems the federal government could have a clear role with the VA. Because so many of the people on the streets are people who served our country and came back and are having problems. In terms of the presidential campaign, though, I think it's also interesting to think of this in terms of what the president says on the stump when he's reaching out to his base, which is he likes to paint liberal cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, Baltimore, cities that are led by Democratic leaders, as, you know, this is the example of Democratic policies, and this is why you should support me.
It was interesting that he said San Diego is doing great on this,
right,
who has a Republican mayor who supports him, and he says LA and San Francisco are a disaster. Said that in the same sentence this week while in California. Meanwhile, another big issue is that of guns. Of course, we saw this week Beto O'Rourke talking about his plan, which essentially would be a mandatory gun buyback plan. Joel, as somebody who's been a supporter of the Second Amendment, what goes through your mind when you hear Beto?
Good luck with that. First of all, I've got the Second Amendment, which will probably prevent most of what he's trying to do. And secondly, nobody knows exactly how many AR-15s there are, but it's somewhere between 5 million and 10 million in the country. He's not going to be able to buy those back. We've seen voluntary buybacks fail, mandatory buybacks. I mean, Beto said He doesn't want the police going and rounding up homeless people, but he does want police going into people's homes and taking their guns away and arresting them if they don't comply. It doesn't really work. It's not going to work in this country. He does something else which I think is confusing to the public, which is he talks about AR-15s and AK-47s in the same breath. And most people know the AK-47 as an automatic weapon, a machine gun. It can have different forms, but that's how most people understand that. And the AR-15 is a semi-automatic. In terms of how it works, it's not different from an ordinary handgun or revolver. One pull of the trigger, one shot. And the main reason people like the AR-15 is the way it looks. It's got that military style, but it doesn't actually function differently. I think people are confused as to how these guns work, and nobody wants automatic weapons, machine guns, on our streets, and they're already outlawed. And he's correct that there are limits set around the Second Amendment, just as there are around other rights in the Bill of Rights. But I don't think Antonin Scalia would agree that the AR-15 is something that the government can ban. And he's now expanded that Beto O'Rourke to other handguns. He said he'll take other semi-automatic weapons away. I just don't think it's practical. Whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing, we can also debate that, but I just don't think it's going to happen in the United States.
Of course, California has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. Mm-hmm. Is this something that we should try out here?
I don't know what the numbers are in terms of how many of those kinds of weapons are in California. We're having a hard enough time empowering the Department of Justice to go reclaim guns from people who we already know shouldn't have them. Yeah. And so it really is a cost factor. And I think, you know, offering buyback won't get to the core culture of why we are such a gun-focused society. I don't know that those people who buy those kinds of firearms are going to be inclined just to get some money to turn them in. I just don't think so.
Yeah.
And now let's get more from our panel and talk about the 2020 race. Joel, Seema have been traveling, as we said, to cover this. Kamala Harris behind in a new poll in California, behind Andrew Yang, according to Emerson. So what's going on there? We start our conversation with Seema.
Seema, let's start with you. You've been out on the road. Where do you see the state of this race?
I mean, this is one poll, but I think this poll does show, you know, this is still fluid. It's still very early. And we have this established top tier, which is, you know, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. And then you have this grouping of other people who are trying to move into that tier. The Andrew Yang finding, who knows if, I mean, he definitely has a little bit of momentum. You see this in other polls. Who knows if he's actually surpassed Kamala Harris? But when you go to his events, his followers are super loyal. They're very tech savvy. They're online. And his message is appealing to an interesting sort of broad group of people, whether it's former Trump backers or former Bernie backers.
Yeah, and Seema has a big article. Mm-hmm. She spent a couple days with him. Check mm-hmm. that out. Joel, your feeling on the state of the race. I know you've covered the debates. You've been out with the candidates.
It's really different depending on where you go. And I think one of the things that could happen, of course, we're still several months out, but one of the things that could happen is you see a split among all the early primary states. Elizabeth Warren is surging right now in Iowa. Bernie Sanders won New Hampshire in 2016, and he's on top in some polls there. Joe Biden has a lock almost on South Carolina. It's very hard to see it going differently. I was down there, and he's got a lot of support, institutional support from the African-American community, churches, unions. And then Nevada, before California votes on Super Tuesday. Nevada. Right now, Biden is leading there. Warren's creeping up. But Kamala Harris has been there many times. I've traveled with her a little bit there. And she could make a play there to try to bring back that top-tier status she had a few weeks ago.
Senator, you're an endorser of Kamala Harris. She's somebody you've worked with, somebody you're friends with. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned, though, that it seems like she's really slipped behind in a lot of these polls, and to see her behind Andrew Yang, somebody who's never even run for office before?
Not at all, because it's so early. And I think every time the American people have an opportunity to see the interaction between the candidates, get exposed to the candidates, you know, the polls adjust pretty significantly. So I think the closer we get to March next year, the more she is able to connect with voters all across this country. She'll have the opportunity to let them know why she would be the best option for all of us to be the next president of our country.
So around the horn, who do you think is going to be the Democratic nominee?
Kamala Harris.
I'm not making predictions.
I'm going to stick with my original prediction and also say Kamala Harris. It's still early, but I think that she checks a lot of boxes, and also there isn't a single constituency within the Democratic Party that has a serious problem with her. She doesn't actually offend anybody. She is acceptable to all the different factions. People will criticize this and that, and she took a beating at the second debate and so forth. But you're going to see a lot of problems come out with various other front runners, and they're going to get attacked. They're starting to go at each other.
Yeah.
And I think she may benefit most, especially as Biden fades.
Yeah.
Where are they going to go?
But she needs Biden to fade. And everybody keeps saying Biden's going to fade. So far, he hasn't faded.
Right. If I can offer some free advice to her, I think she needs to fix some things in her campaign. I don't want to get too specific, but there are some retail campaigning issues there. Just one example. I was here at a rally she held in L.A. It was very well attended, probably about 2,000 people in the room. It was a packed audience. And she was speaking in front of a big American flag. But for some reason, the way they had it set up, the flag was away from the audience. So all the TV cameras were pointed at her and the flag, but they missed all the people. Barack Obama would never have done that. Donald Trump would never have done that. They surround themselves with people all the time. So little things like that. She's got to refine the way her campaign does retail campaigning, social media. Those are fixable things, and I think we've still got long enough for her to make a comeback.
Yeah, you and I at that rally together, and you were at that rally, too.
We were all there. I got to speak at that rally, yes.
Last question has nothing to do with politics, but it's something I find interesting. Emmys this weekend on Fox. Who's going to win the Emmy for Best Drama?
Pose.
I'm going to go Game of Thrones, even though I was not a huge fan of the way that it ended.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, well, Game of Thrones, the most nominations ever, 32 nominations. Game of Thrones has a lot.
We'll see if Game of Thrones indeed does dominate on the Emmys stage this week. My guess is that it will. Thank you so much for listening. Next week on the Issue Is podcast, an interesting show. We're going to be having the Mark Sanford, who's running for president, former governor, former congressman from South Carolina, running against the president as a Republican. Also with us, Jesse Ventura, the former independent governor of Minnesota, wrestling legend, an interesting character. What is he up to these days? And the current prime minister of Armenia is going to be here in Southern California. We will have an exclusive interview with him. So those are three big newsmakers next week on The Issue Is. But for this week, thanks so much for listening. Please leave a review. Please tell people about this. Please share this out in social media. We really appreciate it and helps us to get people to find out about our show. And please contact me at Alex Michelson in social media. I love hearing your feedback. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.